Welcome to Community Encode, the podcast about the people, the human beings behind the commits. I'm here today with Kim Maida. She is a Senior Director of Developer Relations at FusionAuth. Welcome to the show and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hey, Chris. Thanks. And thanks for that introduction. where to start? Like you said, I've actually been working in identity for a little while. I've also worked at Auth0 and Okta, as well as on DevRel at various other startups in between. And I kind of had always found myself gravitating back to identity. So I think recently I finally made the decision of this is my career. I will probably be working in identity for the remainder of my career after kind of yo-yoing back and forth a bunch from it.
What is it for you about like identity management authentication type stuff that is interesting? I think for me and probably for a lot of developers, that's like the thing that we want to think about the least.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I like being the person who thinks about it so that other people don't have to. There are plenty of things like that for me, like DevOps. Like I know enough DevOps to be dangerous because I had to learn it in order to like operate my DigitalOcean VPS. But it's just really not my thing. Like I'm not good at it. I don't retain the information. I had found that with identity and access management, like I do actually retain the information. And I like being a part of critical infrastructure because everybody needs it. It's one of those things that no matter what language you use, no matter what stack you're using, at some point you're going to come across a need for auth in some way. And so some of the other jobs that I've had were very specific to like a certain language or a certain framework. And you know, it was a lot of like, people love this thing. They want to showcase what they've done with it. And interestingly, like when I actually started my DevRel career in auth, so I hadn't kind of experienced things out communities outside of that community before. And then when I did, initially I had been like, oh, it'll be awesome because there's, you know, hundreds of thousands of people are really excited about this thing. They want to showcase their knowledge. And what I found was I just didn't find as much critical meaning in it for me. It was great to help people use things they already loved and already cared about, but that criticality was gone. The sort of idea of if you get this wrong, you will be in big trouble. Like you could potentially have a huge disaster on your hands if you get it wrong. And I think that kind of pressure is something that I really enjoy being in a space that has that around it. Because I do not think that everybody should become an auth expert. I absolutely don't think so. I think
good,
that
because I don't want to be.
Yeah, most people don't want to be. But that's, you know, that's why tools exist. But also there's, you know, certain things that you should probably understand in order to be confident. And there's a significant difference between like knowing everything and knowing enough that you're confident that what you've done is secure and that you've done things right. And I like kind of trying to find that balance of confidence where people can be sure that they can have faith in what they've done so that they can move on and not have to think about it anymore. Versus like, here's the OAuth spec, read it from beginning to end. Like,
right. Yeah, taking a little bit of a step back, I think I want to dig into your history a little bit more, but like just from like a big picture, like from the perspective of somebody who maybe isn't a developer who like is listening to this or who you might just encounter, you know, wherever at a conference or even just in person, like in like the line of the coffee shop, like when you talk about what you do or what like the practice around what you do and talk about in your role in developer relations, like how would you break it down to like the explain it to me like I'm five sort of prompt, you know, like what is the high level like definition of what it is that you are trying to get people to do?
I guess I think there, let me unpack that a little, because I think there were a couple of questions in there.
Probably. I often do that, is just like slide five or six more questions into one question. Yeah.
Okay. So maybe if we back up, I think like the initial question was kind of, and explain like I'm five.
Yeah.
Like, what do I tell people my job is?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So for people who don't, like relatives and family, friends and people like that, I basically say, you know, when you get online and you need to log in to a website or something, like that's the service that my company provides.
That's fair.
And then I usually get a bunch of questions about like, why does everybody have MFA? Like, why do I need this thing? Mm-hmm. But it's that usually leads to further interesting conversations, because mm-hmm. you know, then you can explain like why there are, you know, these additional security precautions for like your bank versus, you know, I don't know, like making a reservation at a restaurant or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
So that's basically what I tell. And then as far as like, I usually don't go as far as like defining authentication and authorization. Most people, like you said, like most people aren't really interested in that level.
Right.
But you know, if I do, then I basically, you know, would say like, authentication is proving who you are, who you say you are. And mm-hmm. then authentication is what can you actually access?
Yeah.
What can you access and do?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you're at FusionAuth, and you're formerly at Auth0 and Okta. And those are, you know, from where I stand in the tech world, like Okta and Auth0 are kind of pretty big players in this space. What was interesting to you about FusionAuth specifically?
So I actually joined Auth0 when they weren't a huge player in the space. Mm-hmm. I think I was like employee number 150 or something. And I got to experience kind of that startup rocket ship phase. And that was really exciting to me. It was my first time working at a startup. We were moving fast and we were breaking things and we were trying to break into like the IM industry to become what they have become now, mm-hmm. You know, which is, I think it's awesome that they've succeeded to that degree, because I remember when nobody knew who we were while working there. And I think that the thing that really excited me about FusionAuth, there's a couple of things, but one being the start, I like working at startups. And I like working at startups that are at, you know, roughly this stage, because everybody makes a huge impact. Mm. And that was kind of one of the things that going to bigger companies and then working at corporations, I felt like I could probably make an impact, but it was going to take me like 2 or 3 years to do it. And at a startup, you can really make and show that impact quite early, and everybody can do it. Like anybody from IC all the way up to, you know, like VP, can have that impact and show it, and everybody can recognize it and see, and you can see what you've done for a company. And I think that kind of more instant gratification is something that I really like about working at smaller companies. And then like, why FusionAuth, especially after working for other IDaaS companies, one of the first questions that I asked when I was approached about the role was, what makes FusionAuth different? Mm-hmm. Because I think after Auth0 got acquired for $6 billion, there were a lot of IDaaS companies that popped up, right? Mm-hmm. And there's way more of them now than there were when I was at Auth0, like by mm-hmm. far. And so they all kind of do the same thing, right? So, you know, my first question is, why FusionAuth? Why are we different? And really, it comes down to, we're downloadable.
Okay.
And so you can run the FusionAuth authorization server as a part of your core infrastructure. And the advantages you get from this, as far as like security and the ability to own everything end to end, are often things that you would like, when people care deeply about that. Like if FusionAuth didn't exist, they'd usually be reaching for like open source solutions, mm-hmm. like Keycloak and that type of thing. And I thought it was really interesting and differentiated that we do on-prem for free. If you want to have an on-prem conversation with a lot of these SaaS companies, that's, you know, locked behind a big sales call, and right. it will cost a lot of money.
So
we also have like a cloud offering, but it's single tenant. So you are the customers who are on the cloud don't share infrastructure with the other customers. So it's dedicated instances, which I think is also cool, but for myself, I'll probably always just download Fusion off whenever I need off, like into the future. Because it was one of those things where I didn't realize how much I liked that, like owning it, until I actually had it like running on my machine and I could put in like a config file and spin up a new environment like really quickly. I could make changes to the environments and, you know, do all of this transferring of configuration and things like that, that I just like wouldn't have been able to do with a SaaS product. And that level of ownership, like there is a movement out there, you know, in general, the local first stuff where people, you know, are really focusing on what can they own and run. And I hadn't really been, you know, part of that community. Like it wasn't necessarily something that I thought too hard about. Most of the companies I worked for were SaaS companies. So I didn't, I think, realize how much I would like it once I could actually like own and control this thing that also is being governed by a body of people who know Auth really well and will make sure that, you know, nothing bad is happening. Whereas, you know, when you implement homegrown, you're kind of at the mercy of your own knowledge. So you could have, it was like you could have the local thing, have your cake and eat it too, which I definitely appreciated and actually hadn't used an Auth solution that did that before.
Yeah, I was actually just like thinking about how like if you, for any SaaS product that's that you're integrating into your site or whatever, like if it's if it's hosted somewhere, then if you're working locally, you have to figure out some way of like either authorizing that local connection or like figure out, so it'd be a huge benefit to just be able to, just for local development and local testing, to be able to stand it up on your own thing, or like in CI even, like
and just like multiple environments, like any anything like that. And like the, I think the configuration thing is something that maybe at FusionAuth we don't talk about enough. You can have this configuration file called a kickstart, and it's basically a JSON file that makes a bunch of calls to the API when you run it. So you can put in like a custom theme, you can have it create specific users, you can have it create applications with a specific ID. It basically anything the API can do, you can put into the kickstart and it will do it for you automatically, like as soon as you spin up, as soon as you like run Docker Compose. And so you can duplicate environments extremely easily that way, and you know, change things that make a change, an environmental change that then you can just give everybody that kickstart file, and a bunch of people can have the same config like in a couple of seconds. And that was something that, especially like for me in DevRel, like creating demos and that type of thing, instead of having like this huge long setup where like first you go into apps and then you have to copy and paste this client ID or whatever, I can just set all of that up for you and you can like be productive right away, which I love. But it was also funny because when I first started at FusionAuth, the very first time I used it and it ran a kickstart, and I was like, oh my God, a bunch of things just happened magically. Like, how do I have all this stuff set up? Like, I didn't know where it came from. I think just because we don't talk about the kickstart very much. But having, you know, done a bunch of things with FusionAuth now, I really like it's one of the highlights for me of the setup process is having the ability to do that.
Yeah, well, that's,
we give full access to the API, like developers can access anything in the API.
And that's part of like the role that we play in DevRel is like when a magic thing happens, like demystifying the magic part, like yeah, it is magic, but also let me walk you through all of those things that just happened that made the magic that you're seeing, so that you don't have to worry about these things.
Yeah And I think that's kind of like the philosophy around how I think about teaching people stuff about Auth. I know for me, like probably the first example of something that I was like, this is a black box and I really mm-hmm. don't understand it was JSON Web Tokens, like how they're signed. and that part was like every article that I ever read was just like, and then you sign it and magic. And I was like, but what's happening? Like, and it was,
what
it
does
was,
that mean? What does those yeah. words mean?
Yeah. But it was interesting. Because it's not that I wanted to do it myself. Like, I didn't want to have to write the code that would actually execute all of that. Like, I'm totally fine using a library.
Yeah.
But it was just this mystery thing that, like,
yeah.
was a secret. And I like exposing those secrets, not so that people can go do it themselves, but so they understand how things work. And then they can have that confidence, again, like, that it's being done right and that they understand what's been done, even if they weren't the ones to actually like write the code or stuff like that.
Yeah.
So
what was your, tell me about your journey into tech broadly and then transitioning like into like developer relations as a focus. I feel like the story of how we get into DevRel is always sort of like, often a meandering sort yes. of journey.
A lot of people just fall into it, or they're doing DevRel for a long time and their role doesn't say developer relations.
Exactly.
They yeah. recognize yeah. that's what they've been doing forever. That actually wasn't the case for me. So I had actually gotten my degree in animal behavior neurobiology.
Totally lends itself to developer relations.
Yeah. As a child, I was like, I'm going to be a doctor. And then I was like, I'm going to be a scientist. And then I went to college for science and I really enjoyed it. Like, I loved it. But then as I was, you know, kind of reaching the end of my degree, it was, you know, abundantly apparent to me that if I wanted to continue to build a career in the things that I was interested in, most likely it would mean that I would need to get a doctorate, and I would also need to teach. Mm-hmm. So I would need to teach college while in the summer I got grants and did research. Right. And the irony is at the time I was like, well, I probably don't want to teach. I don't want to teach people. So, you know, looking back on it now, I probably would have loved it. Maybe yeah. I would have become a college professor instead. But at the time I was like, oh, well, maybe that's not like the thing that I want to spend the next 8 years doing. Mm-hmm. And so I had taught myself how to code, as many people did.
Right.
I think when I was in like fifth grade, I went to a summer science camp and they had like an hour or something that they spent teaching us HTML. And
okay.
this was even like CSS was not a thing yet.
Yeah. Right.
And I had then, you know, gone on to make 500 GeoCities sites on every little thing that I was interested in.
Mm-hmm.
Have the like little
like you do.
Under construction GIF and
yep.
the guest uh-huh. book and
yep.
the page counter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so basically anything that interested me, I just made a GeoCities site about it. And that whole time, like as a kid, it never somehow occurred to me that that could be a career.
Right.
I was just like, this is a thing I do for fun and I'm going to be a scientist. so then it like that perpetuated though all the way kind of through college, because I had decided, okay, maybe I don't want to be a professor, so I'm going to get a second degree in human bio and dietetics, because it overlaps with a lot of the science that I already mm-hmm. had. And while I was doing that degree, which was going to take a much shorter time because I had a lot of prereqs done, but mm-hmm. while I was doing that, I got a job at the university doing front-end development and design and IA. And I was doing that like to, you know, pay the bills. And it was at that time, I still didn't see it as a viable career. Mm-hmm. Like I had a job doing it and I was still like, and I'm going to be, you know, a dietitian now.
Yeah.
And I guess it took a while of me suddenly realizing I wasn't getting paid enough
right.
for my work to actually go and start looking at like other real jobs doing that. And I had basically a full-time job before I graduated, and it was a full-time job at a digital agency, not in science. And I was, you know, leaving a little bit early to finish like my last classes for this other degree. And I think like at that point, I shifted my focus for the degree because I was so deep into getting a second degree. I wanted to still walk away with one. So I switched to like digital media arts and communications, and knew everything that they were teaching us because, you know, they were teaching beginning code stuff.
Right.
So it was easy, but that phase, I think, was when I realized, oh, okay, like, this is going to be my career. It's not anything like what I thought it was going to be, you know, when I was a kid or when I, even when I entered college. So then I worked at digital agencies for a while. I did more front-end development and then eventually did engineering management and architecture and that type of thing. And then I had a baby, and I was gone for like 3 months, and I came back, and I just remember like the designer met me outside the door, like in the parking lot when I was coming back, and he was like, wait until you see this. So I got in and immediately basically started working 100-hour work weeks.
Oof.
I was getting home at like 2 a.m. It was absolutely ridiculous.
No.
So I was missing milestones like for my kid.
Yeah.
And I, you know, had said, okay, I can't sustain this. And so I applied for jobs, and I had met some people at a conference that, you know, I had just attended for work to learn stuff. And they said, oh, we work at Auth0, like you should apply, especially if you like to write and teach, you know, like make tutorials and stuff. And I was like, oh yeah, that sounds fun. So I joined Auth0 on the content team. Basically, we were developers who could write. So everybody was an engineer. Everybody knew how to code, and got to write about pretty much anything that I found interesting, as long as I could tie it in some way back to Auth. And even in those early days, like, we even didn't always write about Auth at all. Like, there are old articles on that blog that don't have anything to do with Auth. But because I later went to a conference and somebody was like, where do you work? And I was like, Auth0. And they were like, oh, I love that blog. Like, they didn't even know we were an Auth company. They just blogged.
Right.
So eventually, you know, I got to a few leadership roles and managing additional teams, and had the opportunity to speak at a conference because we had an advocate who was like on his way out, but he had already made this commitment.
Right.
He didn't actually work at the company anymore at the time of the conference. So he said, do you want to speak with me? Because you do actually still work there. And I thought it sounded terrifying and thought I should definitely do it because it sounds terrifying and it seems like something I should do. And it was terrifying, but I found out that I really, really enjoyed it. So I started applying to speak at more conferences. I started traveling and speaking, and eventually ended up leading Global DevRel at Auth0. Having come from doing a ton of DevRel while I was not on the DevRel team.
Right.
But yeah, ever since then, I have only had DevRel roles after that.
I mean, developers who write is kind of like one of the or two of the qualifications like that I would list under the role of like developer relations anything, you know, like it's such a small Venn diagram because most developers are super just very technical, very like sort of focused on their area of interest, but not necessarily able to make the words good. And it often takes somebody like me, like I wanted to be a writer or something creative, right? Like when I was a kid, I wanted to be a writer or a rock star, one of those two things. And not a rock star in the tech bro sense.
Yeah, no, I
like a literal.
Yeah, yeah, like a singer, songwriter.
I said that out loud and I'm like, wait a second. I don't want to be that kind of rock star.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I you know, did a lot of writing, and so and as a developer, I did a lot of writing too. But it was never part of my job until, you know, I took the role, and I was like, yeah, I'm doing this because I've been doing it, but also because I'm good at it, and it's fun, and it gets to flex the muscles, the creative muscles that I don't get to do in like an engineering role.
Yeah, totally. And that's what, like, I found it really refreshing to coming off of doing all like production work for external clients, who, you know, were various levels of difficult to work with.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure there was anybody who was like really easy to work with. I think it was all just varying levels of difficult. But, you know, I loved it because the work changed all the time.
Right.
And so if you had one hellish project, like hopefully in a year, you wouldn't be on that project anymore. But I really kind of was still able to sort of get that doing the writing because we could basically write about whatever we wanted, whatever mm-hmm. we were interested in. So anything that I wanted to learn, I was just like, okay, I'm going to write an article about this, a tutorial on how to integrate auth with, you know, X new thing that came out because I want to learn
right.
the new thing. So I got farther and farther away from production code. Like I, you know, obviously haven't done client work since then. And once in a while, I kind of miss getting some wireframes and getting a design and slicing it up and doing all the things. Mm-hmm. But I still get to like write a ton of code in these types of roles, and that is another thing that just like I really value about being in DevRel is I still get to write code, but I also get to teach people and do talks and things like that. Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm. And things like this.
Yeah. My brain completely stopped functioning for a second. There is a thing that I was going to ask. Oh my god. tell me about making small things.
So I make miniatures as a hobby. It was a pandemic hobby. Mm-hmm. Ever since I was really little, I had a dollhouse that my grandparents made me, like handmade. And I always loved making little things for the dollhouse. Like I'd make the little Play-Doh hot dog in a bottle cap or something. And so I always was interested in little things. And during the pandemic, I think I was just like looking at stuff on Instagram and stuff. And I was like, oh, people make this amazing, super realistic, tiny food. And it looks so real. And it's so cool. And then I watched a couple of tutorials and I was like, oh, they're using polymer clay. Anybody can buy polymer clay. Like, it's not a special magical thing that you know, need to be super experienced in to even get your hands on. And so I started making miniature polymer clay food and got quite into it, and then started making other things as well. I've made like a Catan board and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And had gotten kind of, through the course of like the tiny things, COVID thing, I started getting into mechanical keyboards and, artisan keycaps. I started experimenting with making artisan keycaps with polymer clay, and there's a lot of kind of thought and design that has to go into that because you need to design them in a way that you're not going to break. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I actually started getting into resin casting. So then I resin cast artisan keycaps as well as make the tiny food and game boards.
Mm-hmm. I remember the thing I was going to say. It sort of tangentially relates because the question we were talking about speaking, and you were talking about being terrified, and developer relations, and from my experience, but also from like I've been speaking at events for long before I was, you know, a developer advocate. But it involves a lot of like speaking or being in front of people or whatever. I, like in high school and into college a little bit, was in really into theater. So like I was in film, and so I was like all about being in front of people, which is another thing that like most engineers like are very much like very introverted, would much rather just sit in a room that is dark and stare at their computer and just type code for without interacting with another human being for most of the day. Whereas I definitely, you know, enjoy being around people or being in spaces where I can, you know, like talk to people and have conversations and things. And that makes, so that makes the speaking thing less, slightly less of a nightmarish, horrifying thing for me, because it's just a form of,
yeah,
of
like a natural,
being on stage thing. Yeah. So all that to say, where on the sort of introversion, extroversion spectrum do you see yourself? Because I have a suspicion.
I'm an outgoing introvert.
Okay.
So I love to speak. I love to interact with people. I love to be out and about and doing these things. And then I need a little bit of time by myself in order to recover.
Yeah.
So I don't, you know, the classic, I think, definition of an extrovert is you get energy by doing those things.
Yeah.
And then introversion is when you get energy by being by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people often confuse introversion and like shyness, or
right.
because you can totally be an extremely outgoing introvert.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that the way you recover from, like, it drains your energy to do that instead of like
yep.
giving you more energy.
Yeah.
So that's definitely where I'd classify myself. But as a child, like, I think the words painfully shy would probably be accurate. Like, like painfully shy, like hide behind my parents, like in public when somebody talked to me type of shy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it surprised even me that this was something that I was actually really interested in.
Yeah.
Like as an adult. But I think speaking, if you are introverted, speaking at conferences is actually an awesome way to go and give people a reason to talk to you.
Yeah.
I've been to conferences alone. It's hard, especially if you're an introvert,
yeah.
To find people to talk to and stuff like that. But if you apply to speak at an event and you get up and speak, people will come and find you and talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that doing a lot more of that also helped me to be less shy.
Yeah, I it's definitely a thing. Like I remember having a conversation with my father-in-law, who would have identified himself as an introvert, but also like he was a pastor. He was like very much in front of people a lot of the time, and like it was just something that he learned to adapt and to be that role, even while it's not necessarily like the natural role. But like because of social circumstance, because he's male, because of all sorts of other reasons, and where he was in this sort of organizations and things that he did, he just sort of gravitated to that thing and just like learned the techniques he needed to kind of muscle through in a way. I definitely find when I go to events and I'm around people all day long, I definitely need that time to recharge. It's like exhausting, but I also, I just always find it interesting because like part of the role of developer relations is the relations part, you know, it's the interacting yeah. with other humans. And so it's like built in. But I don't think that necessarily means that we're all super extroverted. We are also, many of us, still kind of coders at heart.
I wouldn't even say that probably more than half of the people that I know who are in DevRel are introverts.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's basically a discipline that puts you in a position where you will be pulled out of your shell by external factors and you don't have to force yourself out of
yeah.
your own.
Yeah.
And I think that really has, you know, obviously I've gotten more comfortable with all of this stuff, but I had kind of an interesting revelation. I went to Cedar Point. I don't know if you're familiar with Cedar Point. It's a massive roller coaster park in the Midwest.
Yeah.
And I love roller coasters, and I was riding, you know, like the biggest ones, and I realized I don't get nervous about going on roller coasters anymore. like at all. And like, there's no physical reaction. I'm just like, yay. But I realize like how much, you know, people are adrenaline junkies, and you can get that adrenaline the like couple of moments before you walk on stage in front of like a huge crowd. And I had this kind of revelation about the roller coaster thing is like, oh, like that was part of why I like roller coasters, is like feeling that feeling before you get on. And I think that's why I like those few moments before, like peak, they say peak scary is like, you know, the moments that you're walking up to the stage.
Yeah.
And I was like, I haven't spoken in a while because of the pandemic, at least not in like out in an actual physical event.
Right. Right.
And I'm about to do a couple events, and I was kind of like, I hope I get nervous, which is kind of funny, but yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a really interesting insight. Like, I wouldn't even have thought about that connection, but like, yeah, that like the minute that the roller coaster doesn't make you nervous, then it becomes less enjoyable.
Yeah, because like a lot of it is kind of the hype, like,
yeah,
building yourself up to do this thing. And then,
well, and a really good example, like I remember the first roller coaster that I had ever been on was probably Space Mountain at Disneyland, and this was probably maybe the 80s or early 90s. So it was, they've done a couple like renovations of it since then, and it's much less dark and much less scary. But at the time it was like, you go in and it's pitch black, and there's maybe a couple just like tiny little lights that are like stars that are going around. And there's like a loud whooshing, like wind noise. And you can't see anything. And I remember like, and so the sound of people screaming and not being able to see anything. And it was, I remember being terrified as a kid, but I was like muscling through it. And so I tell my partner this, and she's like, you're weird. because like I closed my eyes, and that made it better somehow. I'm not entirely sure how, because you couldn't see anything anyway, but it made it better for me. And then that's how I got through that initial sort of terror of like roller coasters, is I would just close my eyes. But like now, but like I remember that like it was so, there's so much of that. It wasn't even the ride itself. Like, the ride is almost fine. It was like all of the lead up. It's like the ramp up the hill is like hearing the sounds and hearing all of the other stuff and the sound of the coaster itself and like everything. That was the scary part. Like, once you get going, it's like it's 30 seconds of your life. Like, it doesn't even, it's nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess like that like click, click up the hill is like what the walking up to the stage is
the
like.
Anticipation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I hadn't realized just how big of a component that was in my enjoyment of roller coasters until I went and didn't feel it anymore.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is actually really disappointing. Like, what am I gonna, I'm gonna have to like do more crazy or something, because I'm not getting nervous.
Skydiving?
Yeah. I mean, like, we've talked about it a bunch of times, actually, like me and my husband.
I've been taking aerial arts classes. And so like for me, like heights is a thing for me. So like now I can like climb up a silk or whatever and be up at the top and not feel like super scared. But like one of my instructors recently went skydiving and took lots of pictures, and I'm just looking at the pictures like, nope, nope, absolutely not. Nope. I can see, fun for you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's kind of like where I was lukewarm on it for a while, just because I was like, I just don't need to do that.
Yeah.
But now that the roller coaster thing is like not exciting, I was like, maybe that now. Because
what events are you speaking at? You mentioned that you have a couple speaking gigs.
Yeah. So I'll be speaking at JSConf and NGConf, and they're co-located. So they're both in the same place in mid-October. So just like a couple of weeks.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Coming right up. And then where can people find you on the internet and find your tiny things?
My tiny things are on my like art name or whatever is MIHI. It's MIHI-mini.studio. So is Mihi Mini Studio is what it's called. But in general, I think mita.kim/connect is where I is, you know, my equivalent of Linktree is where I'm mostly at. And these days, like, I'm social media wise, I spend more time on LinkedIn than other platforms.
Yeah.
Honestly. But not that this is a bad thing. I'm like acting all disappointed or something.
Right. No, that's true.
You know, like it's been great, but it's just funny because I never really thought of the platform like that before.
Right. No, there's a certain point where I started using LinkedIn more for just using it more, period, honestly. Because there was a long period of time where, like, okay, when I'm looking for a job, that's when I care about my LinkedIn.
Yeah.
But yeah, now I sort of check it more frequently and possibly more than other things as well. Well, thanks for coming on, Kim. Thank you, everybody who might be watching this or coming to this later or listening to this on the audio version. We'll see you on the internet.
Awesome. Great. Thanks so much for having me.